If you have been around here for any time at all, you know then that the Gospel of Mark is both the oldest gospel and the one that is the most succinct. There's really an economy of words in the Gospel of Mark, and it tells Jesus' story really from the beginning of his ministry through his resurrection. I was reading a commentary this past week that said that the Gospel of Mark is like a really good movie trailer. It thrusts you into the action almost immediately, and it takes you to this place where by the time the resurrection has happened, you just want more information to fill in all of the things that might not have been said up to that point. And I think that that's true, particularly in this first chapter. You see, there's no birth narrative or genealogy here. What we have right from the get-go is Jesus' ministry starting with the appearance of John the Baptist. By the time we get to this point in the text that I'm going to be reading from today, Jesus has already called the first four disciples. He has already gone to the synagogue. He has entered the town of Capernaum. And while he's there, he goes into the synagogue because it's the Sabbath day. And the four and Jesus enter, and Jesus begins to teach with authority, and people are amazed at what he says. And then as he is sitting there teaching, a man who is possessed by a demon comes at Jesus. And Jesus immediately exorcises the demon and makes sure that the demon is silent because the demon knows who Jesus is. We pick up now this morning from what happens after Jesus leaves the synagogue, after the word about him is already starting to spread and his fame is becoming known. Listen now to these words starting with the 29th verse. As soon as they left the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told him about her at once. He came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. Then the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That evening at sunset, they brought to him all who were sick or possessed with demons, and the whole city was gathered around the door. And he cured many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. In the morning, while it was still very dark, he got up and went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed. And Simon and his companions hunted for him. When they found him, they said to him, "Everyone is searching for you." He answered, "Let us go on to the neighboring towns so that I may proclaim the message there also, for that is what I came out to do." And he went throughout Galilee proclaiming the message in their synagogues and casting out demons. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I have mentioned more than once, perhaps even from this place, that there are many voices that we are inundated with every single day. Voices that tell us what's important, voices that tell us how to live, voices that tell us what the latest and greatest is. And what's really wonderful about that is that we as human beings always have the ability to choose which of those voices we will listen to. And the implications of that are probably pretty obvious for most of us. We get to choose how we will respond to the voices that we hear all the time, how we will treat other people, how we will think about ourselves, how we will think about the world that we live in. We have the ability then to either listen to those voices, to give them credence and power in our lives, or to just disregard other voices that we might think are not worthy of our time. The problem is that with that freedom comes this familiarity. And sometimes, because we're so used to being able to make those choices, we don't make any choices. We just allow information to come into us and kind of sit and fester in our minds and in our hearts, not discerning at all which might be worth our time and which might not be worth our time. Whose voice will we choose to listen to? What are the things that we will deem important and worthy of our time, and those things that we should and would disregard? Now, I've also mentioned from here more than once my Bible study teacher, my Sunday school leader, my mentor, and my prayer partner, Harvey. So I apologize if you think that I have nobody else in my sphere of influence to talk about. But I will say that Harvey was probably one of those people that modeled what a life perfected in grace really looks like. He was a follower of Christ. He was not perfect, but he fully embraced the life of grace that God had offered to him as a young man, and had lived that life, that perfected life, and modeled what it meant to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And as I was thinking about Harvey during the week, I remembered a Sunday school class where the class had gathered together, and Harvey started the class by telling us a story. And it was his story, and it was particular because it was shocking to us. He had picked up a homeless man off the exit on 35 that he worked off of. He worked at Southwestern Medical Center, and every day he said he passed this homeless man that was begging for money. And so he chose one day to pick the man up in his car, and he brought the man to the farmer's market and brought him plums and some little paper bags and gave him all the change that he had in his pocket and set him up for business on the street corner that he was normally begging on. And Harvey believed that by doing this, he would help the man to get up on his own two feet. To say that there was stunned silence in the room does not fully describe the power of the silence that was in the room in those moments. And we immediately began to protest. I mean, why would you pick up a stranger in your car and drive him around Dallas? I mean, really, didn't he understand that he could be harmed or even killed by doing that? And wasn't that man just okay on the street corner the way he was? He had been there for a long, long time. He had begged on that street corner for a long, long time. And Harvey had always visited with him and talked to him, even gave him money from time to time. And we were very concerned for Harvey's safety and really for the possibility that something could happen to our Sunday school teacher. I mean, he was our Sunday school teacher. And we didn't want anything to happen to him, because who would teach our Sunday school? So, as we continued to protest, Harvey sat quietly in his chair. And finally, when there was a break in the chatter, he looked at us. It was really the face of heavy grief and disappointment. And he went on to teach Sunday school, because after all, that's what he was there to do. He was there to teach us, those of us who claim to be followers of Jesus Christ, the good news, the Word of God. Jesus had four disciples following him. He had already called Peter, Andrew, James, and John, and they had followed him into the synagogue. Jesus had already proclaimed that the reign of God was on earth, because he brought in the reign of God. He had already shown his authority over the evil things in this world by freeing the man from the thing that possessed him. He had already done the thing that he should not have done. Somewhere surely in the back of Jesus' mind, he heard the keepers of the law, those rabbis that said, no work, no healing, no freedom is to be given or performed on the Sabbath. In front of a synagogue full of people, Jesus had worked to free somebody from that which possessed him. As they enter Peter's home, immediately the four tell Jesus about Peter's mother-in-law who is lying in the bed. Not a single one of them gave her a cup of cold water, put a damp cloth on her head to maybe lower her fever, stood over her to pray. We have no indication that they did anything more than go and tell Jesus about her, because maybe somebody else and not them could do something about her condition. So Jesus goes over, and I'm sure that the four are wondering somewhere in the back of their mind, they're hearing those voices. If you touch a sick person, you may become unclean. Or maybe they heard the voice that Jesus has heard, no work will be done on the Sabbath. But whatever their reason, Jesus had already heard another voice, a voice that said that this woman's life was worth more than the law, that this woman was worthy of being healed on the Sabbath, that this woman was a daughter of Abraham, a child of God. And so he grabs her hand and he raises her to life. She sits up in that bed, filled with life, and she serves them. She serves the ones who would not take care of her out of fear. She serves the ones who put the law above her humanity. She serves them. Now, I have to be honest that the first time I read this text, I was really, really annoyed. I mean, this woman is raised up by Jesus, and what does she do? She tidies up the house and fixes dinner. But after all, in her culture, that is her place. That is what she is meant to do. The role of a woman was to keep the home and offer hospitality, radical hospitality. And it didn't matter if you were just laying in a bed and dying. Get up out of that bed and serve those people. Some of you know what I'm talking about. But if we actually read the text carefully, and this is when I realized how wrong I was and how I myself had listened to the voices of a culture that gave people their worth based on the things that they do. But if you read the text carefully, you come to learn that the thing that she did, the service that she offered to them, was not merely tidying the house and fixing a meal. She offered them holy service. The word for the service that she offered is diakonos. It is the holy service that Christ himself offers to us in this place. Remember that the words of Jesus in the Gospels states clearly, I have not come to be served. I have come to serve. diakonos. This unnamed woman who Jesus raises up becomes the first true disciple, the one who follows Jesus because she has been raised up to new life and has recognized the voice of the one who speaks life into her. She's not compelled to serve. She serves out of love. And if you wonder just how important this service is, recall the story of the temptation of Jesus 40 days in the wilderness. And at the end of that story, we hear that the angels came and ministered or served him. What she offers those who have chosen to hear the voices of the culture and of the religion speaking into their lives have been offered the same service that Jesus received from the angels. It is holy and wholesome and life-giving service. This is the service that we are called to offer because it is the service that we receive as followers of Christ. Those four disciples, they witnessed all of this. They also witnessed Christ continuing to heal and to free people all through the night. Even after the sun went down and the Sabbath was over, that work continued. The service of Christ to the most needy in that village continued through the night. There's no indication that those four called disciples ever did anything until the next day. You see, the next day they realize that Christ is nowhere to be found. Where could Jesus have gone? And so the text tells us that the ones who were called to follow are now the ones who are hunting for him. They're not following, they're hunting. In all of the ways that hunting brings those images to your mind, that's what they're doing. Their intent is to lay hands on him when they find him and bring him back so that he can continue to take care of their people in their place at their time. Because after all, they know what's best, the way we know what's best. We know that it's best that our people get taken care of, that our people receive healing, that the ones that we have already decided are worthy of that kind of care and service receive all of it. Those are the voices that we never think about, that somehow weave their way into our minds and our hearts. Those voices get a lot more playtime than we often think about. But Jesus knew who he was, and he knew what he was there to do. He was there to spread the gospel. So he doesn't listen to the voices of those four. He doesn't even offer them any time. It's totally disregarded. He looks at them, and he says, we're going now. We're going to spread the gospel, to bring the good news, to bring the reign of God to bear on all people, in all places, at all times. I'm not going back. I'm going forward. I'm going to take care of the people all over this land, all over the world, that need to know that my grace is available, so that I might serve them and they might know that they have value and worth beyond what their culture, what their families, what their towns, what their governments say that they have. The weeks that followed Harvey's class announcement were very difficult. We had spent a lot of time talking about what was best for him, how he should not be taking care of that homeless man who he regularly updated us on. You see, I think our biggest fear was wrapped up in the reality that Harvey was a paraplegic. And he was so vulnerable. This man could have done anything to him. Taken advantage of him, physically harmed him, stolen from him. And so the day finally came when someone in the class decided enough is enough, and we're going to tell him no more, because we knew what was best for him, and we knew what was best for us. And it was perhaps one of the worst Sundays that we ever had in that class. This man, with tears in his eyes, said to us, "Is this not what we are called to? To take care of the least, the last, and the lost. To raise all people up to new life. To pour into them the gifts that we have been given. To serve them the way Christ serves us." And then he said, "Have you not heard the voice of Christ in anything we have ever talked about in this room? Have all of our prayers gone into the wind?" We had decided that we knew what was best. And we had also decided that Harvey, in his physical condition, was limited. Limited in his ability to take care of others, limited in his ability to love the way Jesus loves. We had made those decisions. And Harvey reminded us that there is a voice louder than what the medical professionals have to say, a voice that is truer than what the culture offers, a voice that responds in love to all the things that we decide about. I believe that on the exit to Southwestern Medical Center off of 35, the reign of Christ came to bear. Through one who was courageous enough to listen to the voice that said, that man that stands there and you talk to week after week is a son of God and is worthy. So whose voice? Whose voice will we choose this day to hear?